This is Tony Infantino welcoming you to Warm 101.3 Angiva Theater Center's special radio presentation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Now, I know many of our listeners have seen Jiva's annual production live on stage at the theater and enjoyed the music, the costumes, the special effects, everything. In fact, for many families, A Christmas Carol is a favorite holiday tradition. Well, this year the theater is closed, of course, due to the pandemic, and Jiva is unable to present this holiday tradition live on stage. But Mark Cuddy, Jiva's artistic director, joins us via Skype tonight and going to tell us how you're keeping the magic alive.
Thanks, Tony. So what everyone's about to hear is an adaptation of Charles Dickens' novella. And one of his favorite ways to spread holiday cheer back in the 19th century was to perform dramatic readings of his beloved ghost story. With a trusty self-edited copy in hand, Dickens took the tale of Ebenezer Scrooge's transformation on the road for years, making a lot of money, standing at podiums and entertaining large crowds of devoted fans. So this isn't Jiva's usual A Christmas Carol. But of course, Tony, this isn't a usual year.
Not at all.
It's a special radio presentation of the story that Rochester actors Esther Winters, Jonathan Nekethah, and myself are performing in the tradition of Charles Dickens. But it will also include some of the wonderful music that Greg Coffin composed for our stage production.
Jiva has had to find a lot of different ways to share theater this year with the building closed to audiences, artists, and staff since mid-March. It's been a very challenging year, but you're still finding ways to share the magic of theater. So if you'd like to help make sure Jiva can continue to produce virtually until we can get back together in the theater, an easy way to do it is by texting the word humbug, H-U-M-B-U-G, to 76278 and make your donation. Every gift will help.
And now the Jiva Theater Center presents their annual holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, from Charles Dickens' beloved holiday classic with music by Greg Coffin. Offered with limited commercial interruption, sponsored by Mark's Pizzeria, exclusively on Warm 101.3.
A Christmas Carol.
Being a ghost story of Christmas.
By Charles Dickens.
In four staves.
And three voices.
Stave one, Marley's ghost.
Marley was dead to begin with. There was no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner, Scrooge. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail.
Scrooge knew he was dead? Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole friend and sole mourner.
Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name, however. There it yet stood, years afterwards, above the warehouse door, Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley. He answered to both names. It was all the same to him.
Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone with Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner.
Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. Even the blind man's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into doorways, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, master."
Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting, foggy weather, and the city clocks had only just gone three, but it was quite dark already.
The door of Scrooge's counting house was open that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room. And so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of a strong imagination, he failed.
A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you!
It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach.
Bah! Humbug!
Oh, Christmas? A humbug? Uncle, you don't mean that, I'm sure.
I do. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older, but not an hour richer. A time for balancing your books and having every item in them presented dead against you. If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should.
Uncle!
Nephew! Keep Christmas in your own way, and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it? But you don't keep it.
Let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you. Much good it has ever done you.
There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say, Christmas among the rest. But I am sure that I have always thought of Christmas Eve as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year, when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow travelers to the grave and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe that it has done me good and will do me good, and I say, God bless it!
The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded.
Let me hear another sound from you, and you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation. You're quite a powerful speaker, sir. I wonder you don't go into Parliament.
Oh, don't be angry, Uncle. Come, dine with us tomorrow.
Scrooge said that he would see him. Yes, indeed he did. He went the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first.
But why? Why?
Why did you get married?
Well, because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love? Good afternoon.
Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it as a reason for not coming now?
Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon.
I am sorry with all my heart to find you so resolute. We have never had any quarrel to which I have been a party. But I have made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So a Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
And a Happy New Year.
Good afternoon.
His nephew left the room without an angry word, notwithstanding. The clerk, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years, Scrooge replied. He died 7 years ago this very night.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons, but under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the prisons and the workhouses, and those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentlemen withdrew. At length, the hour of shutting up the counting house arrived. With an ill will, Scrooge dismounted from his stool and tacitly admitted the fact to the expectant clerk in the tank, who instantly snuffed his candle out and put on his hat.
You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose?
If quite convenient, sir.
It's not convenient, and it's not fair. If I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, I'll be bound.
Yes, sir.
And yet you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work, a poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December. But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier next morning.
The clerk promised that he would, and Scrooge walked out with a growl. The office was closed in a twinkling, and the clerk, with the long ends of his white comforter dangling below his waist, for he boasted no greatcoat, went down a slide on Corn Hill, at the end of a lane of boys, 20 times, in honor of its being Christmas Eve, and then ran home to Camden Town as hard as he could pelt.
Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, and having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. They were a gloomy suite of rooms, the building old enough now and dreary enough, for nobody lived in it but Scrooge. Now it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the door, except that it was very large. Also that Scrooge had seen it, night and morning, during his whole residence in that place. Also that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the City of London. And yet Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker not a knocker, but Marley's face. Marley's face, with a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. It was not angry or ferocious, but looked at Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up on its ghostly forehead. As Scrooge looked fixedly at this phenomenon, it was a knocker again. He said, "Pooh-pooh," and closed the door with a bang. The sound resounded through the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellars below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door and walked across the hall and up the stairs. Slowly, too, trimming his candle as he went.
Up Scrooge went, not caring a button for its being very dark. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it. But before he shut his heavy door, he walked through his rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of the face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom, lumber room, all as they should be. Nobody under the table, nobody under the sofa, a small fire in the grate, spoon and basin ready, and the little saucepan of gruel upon the hob. Nobody under the bed, nobody in the closet, nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. He closed his door and locked himself in. Double locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers, and his nightcap, and sat down before the fire to take his gruel.
As he threw his head back in the chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell, a disused bell that hung in the room and communicated for some purpose now forgotten with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was with great astonishment and with a strange, inexplicable dread that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. Soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. This was succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the casks in the wine merchant's cellar. Then he heard the noise much louder on the floors below, then coming up the stairs, then coming straight towards his door. It came on through the heavy door, and a specter passed into the room before his eyes. And upon its coming in, the dying candle flame leaped up as though it cried, I know him, Marley's ghost. The same face, the very same. Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights and boots. His body was transparent so that Scrooge, observing him, looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he had never believed it until now. No, nor did he believe it even now, though he looked the phantom through and through and saw it standing before him, he was still incredulous.
How now? What do you want with me?
Much.
Who are you?
Ask me who I was.
Who were you then?
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
Can you sit down?
I can.
Do it then.
Scrooge asked the question because he didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace, as if he were quite used to it.
You don't believe in me.
I don't.
Why do you doubt your senses?
Because a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheats. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are.
Scrooge was not much in the habit of cracking jokes, nor did he feel in his heart by any means waggish then. The truth is that he tried to be smart as a means of distracting his own attention and keeping down his horror. But how much greater was his horror when the phantom, taking off the bandage round his head as if it were too warm to wear indoors, its lower jaw dropped down to its breast.
Mercy! Dreadful apparition! Why do you trouble me? Why do spirits walk the earth? Why do they come to me?
It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death. My spirit never walked beyond our money-changing hole, and weary journeys lie before me.
But you are always a good man of business, Jacob.
Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business.
It held up its chain at arm's length as if that were the cause of all its unavailing grief, and flung it heavily upon the ground again.
At this time of year, I suffer most. Why did I walk through crowds of fellow beings with my eyes turned down, and never raise them to that blessed star which led the wise men to a poor abode? Were there no poor homes to which its light would have conducted me?
Scrooge was very much dismayed to hear the specter going on at this rate, and began to quake exceedingly.
Hear me. My time is nearly gone.
I will, but don't be hard upon me, Jacob, pray.
I am here tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate. A chance and hope of my procuring Ebenezer.
You are always a good friend to me. Thank you.
You will be haunted by three spirits.
Is that the chance and hope you mentioned, Jacob? I think I'd rather not.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow when the bell tolls one. Expect the second on the next night at the same hour. The third upon the next night when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate. Look to see me no more, and look that for your own sake. You remember what has passed between us.
It walked backward from him, and at every step it took, the window raised itself a little, so that when the specter reached it, it was wide open. Scrooge closed the window and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double-locked as he had locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed. Scrooge tried to say humbug, but stopped at the first syllable. And being from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or his glimpse of the invisible world, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, went straight to bed without undressing, and fell asleep upon the instant.
Warm 101.3, this is Tony Infantino, and you're listening to a special radio presentation of A Christmas Carol, presented by Jeeva Theater Center. Charles Dickens' beloved tale has been Jeeva's holiday spectacular for 25 years. This kind of tradition doesn't happen without a lot of support, such as from KeyBank, presenting sponsor of A Christmas Carol. This year, when the stages at Jeeva Theater are closed due to the pandemic, KeyBank is continuing its support with a gift of $20,000 and a challenge to raise another $20,000 from the community before the end of 2020. To help Jeeva meet the KeyBank 2020 challenge, text HUMBUG, H-U-M-B-U-G, to 76278. Or visit JeevaTheater.org to make your gift. Every gift, no matter how big or small, will help to make live professional theater in Rochester possible.
Now, back to the Jeeva Theater Center's annual holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, exclusively on Warm 101.3.
Stave 2, The First of the Three Spirits. When Scrooge awoke, it was so dark that looking out of bed, he could scarcely distinguish the transparent window from the opaque walls of his chamber, until suddenly the church clock tolled a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy one.
Light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn by a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man, viewed through some supernatural medium which gave him the appearance of having receded from the view and being diminished to a child's proportions. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on the skin. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand, and, in singular contradiction of that wintry emblem, had its dress trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing about it was that from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light, by which all this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap, which it now held under its arm.
Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered, what was light one instant at another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, now being a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body. And in the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clear as ever. Are you the spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?
I am.
Who and what are you?
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Long past?
No, your past. The things you will see with me are shadows of the things that have been. They will have no consciousness of us.
It reached out as it spoke and gripped him gently by the hand.
Rise and walk with me.
It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted to pedestrian purposes, that his bed was warm and the thermometer a long way below freezing, that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown, and nightcap, and that he had a cold upon him at that time. The grasp, though gentle, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made towards the window, clasped his robe in supplication.
I am a mortal and liable to fall.
Bear but a touch of my hand there,
laying it upon his heart.
And you shall be upheld in more than this.
As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood in the busy thoroughfares of a city. It was made plain enough by the dressing of the shops that here, too, it was Christmas time again.
The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it.
Know it, said Scrooge. I was apprenticed here.
They went in. At sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig, sitting behind such a high desk that if he had been 2 inches taller, he must have knocked his head against the ceiling, Scrooge cried,
"Why, it's old Fezziwig, bless his heart. It's Fezziwig alive again."
Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up at the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands, adjusted his capacious waistcoat, laughed all over himself from his shoes to his organ of benevolence, and called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice,
"Yo-ho there, Ebenezer! Dick!"
A living and moving picture of Scrooge's former self, a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow apprentice.
"Dick Wilkins, to be sure. Bless me, yes, there he is. He was very much attached to me, was Dick. Poor Dick, dear, dear."
"Yo-ho, my boys! No more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick. Christmas, Ebenezer. Let's have the shutters up before a man can say Jack Robinson. Clear away, my lads, and let's have lots of room here."
Clear away! There was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away or couldn't have cleared away with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. Every movable was packed off as if it were dismissed from public life forevermore. The floor was swept and watered, the lamps were trimmed, fuel was heaped upon the fire, and the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night.
In came a fiddler with a music book and went up to the lofty desk and tuned it like 50 stomach aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came the 3 Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the 6 young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In they all came, and away they all went, 20 couple at once, hands half round and back again the other way, down the middle and up again, round and round in affectionate groupings. Old Fezziwig, clapping his hands to stop the dance, cried out, "Well done!" And the fiddler plunged his hot face into a pot of porter, especially provided for that purpose.
There were more dances, and there were games, and more dances, and there was cake, and there was a great piece of cold roast, and there was a great piece of cold boiled, and there were mince pies, and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the roast and boiled, when the fiddler struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig.
As to her, she was worthy to be his partner in every sense of the term. A positive light appeared to issue from Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance. You couldn't have predicted at any given time what would have become of them next. And when old Fezziwig and Mrs. Fezziwig had gone all through the dance, Fezziwig cut so deftly that he appeared to wink with his legs.
When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. When everybody had retired but the 2 prentices, they did the same to them, and thus the cheerful voices died away, and the lads were left to their beds, which were under a counter in the back shop.
"A small matter to make these silly folk so full of gratitude. He has spent but a few pounds of your mortal money. Is that so much that he deserves this praise?"
"Oh, it isn't that," said Scrooge, heated by the remark and speaking unconsciously like his former, not his latter self. "It isn't that, Spirit. He has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune."
He felt the Spirit's glance and stopped.
"What is the matter?"
"Nothing particular."
"Something, I think?"
"No, no. I should like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now. That's all."
"My time grows short. Quick!"
This was not addressed to Scrooge or to anyone whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect, for again Scrooge saw himself, He was older now, a man in the prime of life.
He was not alone, but sat by the side of a fair young girl in a black dress, in whose eyes there were tears. It matters little, to you very little. Another idol has displaced me, and if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I have no just cause to grieve.
What idol has displaced you?
A golden one. I have seen your nobler aspirations fall off one by one until the master passion gain engrosses you, have I not?
What then? Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I am not changed towards you. Have I ever sought release from our engagement?
In words, no, never.
In what then?
In a changed nature, in an altered spirit. If you were free today, tomorrow, yesterday, can even I believe that you would choose a dowerless girl? Or choosing her, do I not know that your repentance and regret would surely follow? I do, and I release you, with a full heart, for the love of him you once were.
Spirit, remove me from this place.
I told you these were shadows of the things that have been, that they are what they are. Do not blame me.
Remove me. I cannot bear it. Leave me, take me back. Haunt me no longer.
In the struggle, if that can be called a struggle, Scrooge observed that the spirit's light was burning high and bright, and dimly connecting that with its influence over him, he seized the extinguisher cap and by a sudden action pressed it down upon its head. The spirit dropped beneath it so that the extinguisher covered its whole form, but though Scrooge pressed it down with all his force, he could not hide the light, which streamed from under it in an unbroken flood upon the ground. As he struggled with the spirit, he was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness, and further, of being in his own bedroom. He gave the cap a parting squeeze, in which his hand relaxed, and had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep.
Warm 101.3, this is Tony Infantino, and you're listening to a special radio presentation of A Christmas Carol, presented by Jiva Theater Center. Each year, 16 local children appear live on stage in Jiva's production. They rehearse with director Mark Cuddy, receive voice and movement coaching, and join the professional adult actors in performing Jiva's holiday production. And while the theater is currently dark due to the pandemic, KeyBank, presenting sponsor of A Christmas Carol, is continuing its support with a gift of $20,000 to Jiva and a challenge to raise another $20,000 from the community before the end of 2020. To help Jiva meet the KeyBank 2020 challenge, text HUMBUG, H-U-M-B-U-G, to 76278 or visit jivatheater.org to make your gift. You can help keep experiences like this alive.
Now, back to the Jiva Theater Center's annual holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, exclusively on Warm 101.3.
Stave 3, the second of the three spirits. Scrooge awoke in his own bedroom. There was no doubt about that. But his adjoining sitting room, into which he shuffled in his slippers, attracted by a great light there, had undergone a surprising transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove. The leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy reflected back the light as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there. And such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that hearth had never known in Scrooge's time. Heaped up on the floor, to form a kind of throne, were turkeys, geese, game, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense twelfth cakes, and great bowls of punch.
In easy state upon this couch, there sat a giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and who raised it high to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door.
Come in. Come in and know me better, man. I am the ghost of Christmas present. Look upon me. You have never seen the like of me before.
Never.
Have never walked forth with my elder brothers born in these later years?
I don't think I have. I am afraid I have not. Have you had many brothers, Spirit?
More than 1,800.
A tremendous family to provide for. Spirit, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learnt a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it.
Touch my robe.
Scrooge did as he was told and held it fast. All vanished instantly, the room and its contents, and they stood in the city streets upon a snowy Christmas morning.
Scrooge and the ghost passed on, invisible, straight to Scrooge's clerks. And on the threshold of the door, the spirit smiled and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling with the sprinkling of his torch. Think of that! Bob had but 15 bob a week himself, and yet the ghost of Christmas present blessed his four-roomed house.
Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence. And she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, second of her daughters, also brave in ribbons, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and getting the corners of his monstrous shirt collar into his mouth, the collar being Bob's private property conferred upon his son and heir in honor of the day, rejoiced to find himself so gallantly attired.
And now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it for their own. And basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion, these young Cratchits danced about the table and exalted Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he, not proud, although his collars nearly choked him, blew the fire until the slow potatoes, bubbling up, knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled.
"What has ever got your precious father, then?" said Mrs. Cratchit. "And your brother, Tiny Tim? And Martha weren't as late last Christmas Day by half an hour?"
"Here's Martha, mother," said a girl, appearing as she spoke. "Here's Martha, mother," cried the two young Cratchits. "Hurrah! There's such a goose, Martha!"
"Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are!"
"We'd a deal of work to finish up last night," replied Martha, "and had to clear away this morning, mother."
"Well, never mind, so long as you are come. Sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm. Lord bless ye!"
"No, no, there's father coming!" cried the two young Cratchits, who were everywhere at once. "Hide, Martha, hide!" So Martha hid herself, and in came Bob, with at least 3 feet of comforter exclusive of the fringe hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Tiny Tim, he bore a little crutch and had his limbs supported by an iron frame.
"Why, where's our Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking around.
"Not coming."
"Not coming? Not coming upon Christmas Day?"
Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, so she came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms, while the two young Cratchits bore Tiny Tim off into the wash-house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper.
"And how did little Tim behave?"
"As good as gold and better. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much and thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hoped the people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see."
Bob's voice was tremulous when he told them this, and trembled more when he said that Tiny Tim was growing strong and hardy.
His active little crutch was heard upon the floor, and back came Tiny Tim before another word was spoken, escorted by his brother and sister to his stool before the fire. And while Bob compounded some hot mixture in a jug with gin and lemons and stirred it round and round and put it on the hob to simmer, Master Peter and the two ubiquitous young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they soon returned in high procession.
Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, and mounting guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths, lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. At last, the dishes were set on, and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause, as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it in the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all round the board, and even Tiny Tim beat on the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried, "Hurrah!"
There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone to take the pudding up and bring it in.
Suppose it should be not done enough. Suppose it should break in turning out. Suppose somebody should have got over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose, a supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horrors were supposed.
Hello! A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other, with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball, so hard and firm, blazing in ignited brandy and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top.
Oh, a wonderful pudding! Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess she had had her doubts about the quantity of flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family.
At last the dinner was all done, the cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. The compound in the jug being tasted and considered perfect, apples and oranges were put upon the table and a shovelful of chestnuts on the fire. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, and at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks while the chestnuts on the fire sputtered and cracked noisily. Then Bob proposed,
"A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us."
Which all the family re-echoed.
And last of all, Tiny Tim said, "God bless us, everyone." He sat very close to his father's side upon his little stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his and dreaded that he might be taken from him.
Scrooge raised his head speedily on hearing his own name.
"Mr. Scrooge," said Bob. "I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast."
"The founder of the feast, indeed. I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have a good appetite for it."
"My dear, the children, Christmas Day."
"It should be Christmas Day, I am sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow."
"My dear, Christmas Day."
"I'll drink his health for your sake and the day's, not for his. Long life to him. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt."
The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. After it had passed away, they were 10 times merrier than before from the mere relief of Scrooge being done with. Bob Cratchit told them how he had a situation in his eye for Master Peter,
which would bring in, if obtained, full 5 and 6 pence weekly. The two young Cratchits laughed tremendously at the idea of Peter's being a man of business, and Peter himself looked thoughtfully at the fire from between his collars, as if he were deliberating what particular investments he should favor when it came into the receipt of that bewildering income.
Martha, who was a poor apprentice at a milliner's, then told him what kind of work she had to do and how many hours she worked at a stretch, and how she meant to lie abed tomorrow morning for a good long rest. All this time, the chestnuts and the jug went round and round, and by and by they had a song about a lost child traveling in the snow from Tiny Tim, who had a plaintive little voice and sang it very well indeed.
There was nothing of high mark in this. They were not a handsome family. They were not well-dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof, and Peter might have known the inside of a pawnbroker's. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. And when they faded, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially on Tiny Tim until the last.
It was a great surprise to Scrooge as this scene vanished to hear a hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognize it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a bright, dry, gleaming room, with the spirit standing smiling by his side and looking at that same nephew. It is a fair adjustment of things that while there is infection in disease and sorrow, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humor. When Scrooge's nephew laughed, Scrooge's niece by marriage laughed as heartily as he, and their assembled friends, being not a bit behindhand, roared out lustily. "He said that Christmas was a humbug as I live," cried Scrooge's nephew. "He believed it, too."
"More shame for him, Fred," said Scrooge's niece indignantly.
"He's a comical old fellow, that's the truth, and not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offenses carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him. Who suffers by his ill whims? Himself, always. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequence? He don't lose much of a dinner."
"Indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner."
Everybody else said the same, and they must be allowed to have been competent judges because they had just had dinner. And with the dessert upon the table, were clustered around the fire by lamplight.
"Well, I'm very glad to hear it, because I haven't great faith in these young housekeepers. What do you say, Topper?"
Topper had clearly got his eye upon one of Scrooge's niece's sisters, for he answered that a bachelor was a wretched outcast who had no right to express an opinion on the subject. Whereat Scrooge's niece's sister, the plump one with the lace tucker, not the one with the roses, blushed. After tea, they had some music, for they were a musical family and knew what they were about when they sung a glee or catch, I can assure you. But they didn't devote the whole evening to music. After a while, they played games, for it is good to be children sometimes. There was first a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something, and the rest must find out what, he only answering to their questions yes or no, as the case was. The fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited from him that he was thinking of an animal, a live animal, a rather disagreeable animal, a savage animal, an animal that growled and grunted sometimes, and talked sometimes, and lived in London, and walked about the streets, and wasn't made a show of, and wasn't led by anybody, and didn't live in a menagerie, and was never killed in a market, and was not a horse, or an ass, or a cow, or a bull, or a tiger, or a dog, or a pig, or a cat, or a bear. At every fresh question that was put to him, this nephew burst into a fresh roar of laughter and was so inexpressibly tickled that he was obliged to get up off the sofa and stamp. At last, the sister cried out, "I have found it! I know what it is, Fred! I know what it is!"
"What is it?"
"It's your Uncle Scrooge!"
Which it certainly was. Admiration was the universal sentiment, though some objected that the reply to, "Is it a bear?" ought to have been, "Yes."
Uncle Scrooge had imperceptibly become so gay and light of heart that he would have pledged the company in a speech. but the whole scene passed off in the breath of the last word spoken by his nephew, and he and the spirit were again upon their travels. Much they saw, and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy end. The spirit stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful. On foreign lands, and they were close at home. By struggling men, and they were patient in their greater hope. By poverty, and it was rich. In almshouse, hospital, and jail, in misery's every refuge, where vain man in his little brief authority had not made fast the door and barred the spirit out, he left his blessing and taught Scrooge his precepts. Suddenly, as they stood together in an open place, the bell struck 12. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost and saw it no more. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming, like a mist along the ground, towards him.
Warm 101.3, this is Tony Infantino, and you're listening to a special radio presentation of A Christmas Carol, presented by Jiva Theater Center. It takes a small army of people to present A Christmas Carol live on stage at Jiva. Set, costume, lighting, and sound designers, carpenters, painters, dressers, musicians, and of course the actors, most of whom aren't working right now. But Jiva continues to produce and share theater virtually until it's safe to return to the theater. And while the stages at Jiva are currently dark due to the pandemic, KeyBank, presenting sponsor of A Christmas Carol, is continuing its support with a gift of $20,000 to Jiva and a challenge to raise another $20,000 from the community before the end of 2020. To help Jiva meet the KeyBank 2020 challenge, text HUMBUG, H-U-M-B-U-G, to 76278 or visit jivatheater.org to make your gift. With your help, we can ensure that the theater makers and live theater return to Jiva. Now, the conclusion of A Christmas Carol. I can't wait to hear how it ends.
Now, back to the Jiva Theater Center's annual holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, exclusively on Warm 101.3.
Stave 4, The Last of the Spirits. The phantom slowly, gravely, silently approached. When it came near him, Scrooge bent down upon his knee, for in the very air through which this spirit moved, it seemed to scatter gloom and mystery. It was shrouded in a deep black garment, which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. Scrooge knew no more, for the spirit neither spoke nor moved.
I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Ghost of the future. I fear you more than any specter I have seen. But as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company, and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?
It gave him no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them.
Lead on, lead on. The night is waning fast, and it is precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit.
They scarcely seemed to enter the city, for the city rather seemed to spring up about them and encompass them of its own act. But there they were in the heart of the exchange, amongst the merchants. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
No, said a great fat man with a monstrous chin. I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead.
When did he die? Inquired another.
Last night, I believe.
Why, what was the matter with him? I thought he'd never die.
God knows.
What has he done with his money? Asked a red-faced gentleman.
I haven't heard. His company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me. That's all I know. Bye-bye.
Scrooge was at first inclined to be surprised that the spirit should attach importance to conversations apparently so trivial, but feeling assured that they must have some hidden purpose, he set himself to consider what it was likely to be. They could scarcely have any bearing on the death of Jacob Marley, his old partner, for that was past, and this coast's province was the future. He looked about for his own image, but another man stood in his accustomed corner, and though the clock pointed to his usual time of day for being there, he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes that poured through.
They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town, to a low shop where iron, old rags, bottles, and greasy bones were bought. A gray-haired rascal of great age sat smoking his pipe. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she had scarcely entered when another woman, similarly laden, came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black. After a short period of blank astonishment, they all three burst into a laugh.
"Let the charwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we haven't all three met here without meaning it."
"You couldn't have met in a better place. You were made free of it long ago, you know, and the other two ain't strangers. What have you got to sell, huh? What have you got to sell?"
"Half a minute's patience, Joe, and you shall see. What odds, then? Huh? What odds, Mrs. Dilber? Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like this? Not a dead man, I suppose."
Mrs. Dilber, whose manner was remarkable for general appeasement, said,
"No, indeed, ma'am."
"If he wanted to keep him after he was dead, why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death instead of lying gasping out his last breath alone by himself."
"It's the truest word that ever was spoke. It's a judgment on him."
"Open that bundle, old Joe, and let me know the value of it."
Joe went down on his knees for the greater convenience of opening it and dragged out a large and heavy roll of some dark stuff.
What do you call this? Oh, bed curtains!
Bed curtains! Don't drop that oil upon the blankets now."
"His blankets?"
"Whose else do you think? He isn't likely to take cold without him. You may look through that shirt till your eyes ache, but you won't find a hole in it. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't been for me."
Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror.
"Spirit, I see. The case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heaven, what is this?"
The scene had changed, and now he almost touched a bare, uncurtained bed, and on it, unwatched, unwept, uncared for, was the body of this plundered man unknown.
"Spirit, let me see some tenderness connected with the death, or this dark chamber, spirit, will be forever present to me."
The ghost conducted him to Bob Cratchit's house and found the mother and the children seated round the fire. Quiet, very quiet. The mother and her daughters were engaged in sewing. The noisy little Cratchits were as still as statues in one corner and sat looking up at Peter, who had a book before him.
"And he took a child and set him in the midst of them."
Where had Scrooge heard those words? He had not dreamed them. The boy must have read them out as he and the spirit crossed the threshold. Why did he not go on? The mother laid her work upon the table and put her hand up to her face. "Oh, the color of the cloth hurts my eyes."
"The color?"
"They're better now again. It makes them weak by candlelight, and I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home for the world. It must be near his time."
"Past it, rather. But I think he has walked a little slower than he used these few last evenings, mother."
I have known him walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed."
"And so have I, often."
"And so have I," exclaimed another. so had all.
But he was very light to carry, and his father loved him so that it was no trouble. No trouble. Oh, and there's your father at the door.
She hurried out to meet him, and Bob came in. His tea was ready for him on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. Then the two young Cratchits got upon his knees, and each child laid a little cheek against his face, as if they said, "Don't mind it, father. Don't be grieved." Bob was very cheerful with them, and spoke pleasantly to all the family. He looked at the work upon the table and praised the industry and speed of Mrs. Cratchit and the girls. They would be done long before Sunday, he said.
Sunday? You went today, then, Robert?
Yes, my dear. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that I would walk there on a Sunday. My little, little child. My little child.
Spectre, something informs me that our parting moment is at hand. I know it, but I know not how. Tell me, what man that was whom we saw lying dead?
The ghost of Christmas yet to come conveyed him to a dismal, wretched, ruinous churchyard. The spirit stood among the graves and pointed down to one.
Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they the shadows of things that may be only?
Still the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood.
Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends, to which, if persevered in, they must lead. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me.
The spirit was immovable as ever. Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name, Ebenezer Scrooge.
Am I that man who lay upon the bed? No, spirit, oh no, no. Spirit, hear me. I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been. Why show me this if I am past all hope? Assure me that I may yet change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life.
For the first time, the kind hand faltered.
I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may sponge away the writing on this stone.
Holding up his hands in a last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. Yes, and the bedpost was his own. The bed was his own. The room was his own. Best and happiest of all, the time before him was his own, to make amends in. He was checked in his transports by the churches ringing out the lustiest bells he had ever heard. Running to the window, he opened it and put out his head. No fog, no mist, no night. Clear, bright, stirring, golden day! What's today? Calling downward to a boy in Sunday clothes.
Eh?
What's today, my fine fellow?
Today? Why, Christmas Day.
It's Christmas Day? I haven't missed it. Hello, my fine fellow!
Hello!
Do you know the Poulters? In the next street but one at the corner.
I should hope I did.
An intelligent boy. A remarkable boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one.
What? The one as big as me?
What a delightful boy. Yes, my buck!
It's hanging there now.
Is it? Go and buy it.
Walker!
No, no, I am in earnest. Go and buy it and tell them to bring it here, that I may give them the direction where to take it. Come back with the man, and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes, and I'll give you half a crown.
The boy was off like a shot.
I'll send it to Bob Cratchit's. He shan't know who sends it. It's twice the size of Tiny Tim.
The hand in which he wrote the address was not a steady one, but write it he did somehow, and went downstairs to open the street door, ready for the coming of the poulterer's man. It was a turkey. He never could have stood upon his legs, that bird. He would have snapped him short off in a minute, like sticks of sealing wax.
He dressed himself all in his best, and at last got out into the streets. The people were by this time pouring forth, as he had seen them with the Ghost of Christmas Present, and walking with his hands behind him, Scrooge regarded everyone with a delighted smile. He looked so irresistibly pleasant that three or four good-humored fellows said, "Good morning, sir! A Merry Christmas to you!" And Scrooge said often afterwards that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest in his ears. In the afternoon, he turned his steps towards his nephew's house. He passed the door a dozen times before he had the courage to go up and knock. But he made a dash and did it.
Is your master at home, my dear?
Yes, sir.
Where is he, my love?
He's in the dining room, sir, along with mistress.
He knows me.
With his hand already on the dining room lock.
I'll go in here, my dear. Fred!
Why, bless my soul! Who's that?
It's I, your Uncle Scrooge. I have come to dinner. Will you let me in, Fred?
Let him in? It is a mercy he didn't shake his arm off. He was at home in 5 minutes. Nothing could be heartier. His niece looked just the same. So did Topper when he came. So did the sister when she came. So did everyone when they came. Wonderful party. Wonderful games. Wonderful happiness.
But he was early at the office next morning. Oh, he was early there. If he could only be there first and catch Bob Cratchit coming late. That was the thing he had set his heart upon. And he did it. Yes, he did. The clock struck 9. No Bob. A quarter past. No Bob. He was a full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. Scrooge sat with his door wide open that he might see him come into the tank. Bob's hat was off before he opened the door, his comforter too. He was on his stool in a jiffy, driving away with his pen as if he were trying to overtake 9 o'clock.
"Hello," growled Scrooge in his accustomed voice, as near as he could feign it. "What do you mean by coming here at this time of day?"
"I am very sorry, sir. I am behind my time."
"You are? Yes, I think you are. Step this way, if you please."
"It's only once a year, sir. It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir."
"Now I'll tell you what, my friend. I am not going to stand this sort of thing any longer. And therefore..."
Scrooge continued, leaping from his stool and giving Bob such a dig in the waistcoat that he staggered back into the tank again.
"And therefore, I am about to raise your salary."
Bob trembled and got a little nearer to the ruler. He had a momentary idea of knocking Scrooge down with it, holding him, and calling to the people outside for help.
"A Merry Christmas, Bob,"
as he clapped him on the back.
"A merrier Christmas, Bob, my good fellow, than I have given you for many a year. I'll raise your salary and endeavor to assist your family, and we will discuss your affairs this very afternoon over a Christmas bowl of smoking bishop, Bob. Make up the fires and buy another coal scuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit."
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all, and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him.
He had no further intercourse with spirits, and it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, every one.
You've been hearing a special presentation of the Jiva Theater Center's annual holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, exclusively on Warm 101.3. Adapted by artistic director Mark Cuddy from Charles Dickens' beloved holiday classic, and music by Greg Coffin. Offered with limited commercial interruption, sponsored by Mark's Pizzeria. Thanks for listening, and season's greetings from Warm 101.3.